Holy shit, there's a bunch of you guys in here. Oh, I'm Bill and I'm an alcoholic. What? There's no microwave in the kitchen. So, I hope you like my outfit. Thought about dressing up for you guys. I prayed and meditated on it. The answer to prayer was I should definitely dress up tonight. I called my sponsor. He said you should probably dress up tonight. But then my wife said, are you going to wear that? Yes, I am. So here we are. My sobriety date is December 22nd, 2008. Thank you. I just celebrated 9 years, and it's been the best 9 years of my life. I cry when I tell my story. Mostly because there's no fucking time machine, you know, to go back and tell that guy, you don't have to live like that. And as you all know, I was pretty much, I'm the only person that could go back in time and tell him that, you know, for him to believe it. So, 12 years of active alcoholism. What happened? Well, what was it like? Well, I got married. And shortly after I got married, I started having debilitating panic attacks. When I say 100, 200 a day, that's not an exaggeration. There were months where I didn't leave my couch. And I discovered that if I was drunk, they went away. I could have a little bit of control over whatever was happening to me. And so I started getting drunk every day. I would say that for a few years, there was no more than 2 or 3 sober hours in every day, and those were excruciatingly painful. And eventually, that marriage ended, but the alcoholism didn't. So, she and I, we get divorced. There's a lot of relationships in my story, a lot of power imbalance relationships, where I had all the power and I really didn't give a shit about the person that I was with. And that's the way I liked it. No investment, didn't have to care. And that's kind of the way I kept things. So you fast forward a few years. We're in 2007. And I'm managing the steakhouse out in Spicewood, Texas. It's an interesting place. The guy who owns the place has suffered from cancer 3 times. So he has a really lax policy on marijuana smoking where we work, right? He smokes, everybody lights up at the beginning of the shift. I've never been much of a pot guy, but I like my booze, and he didn't seem to have a problem with that either. So I'm managing the steakhouse, and there's one rule. The staff cannot date each other. And there was a reason for that. One of the waitresses was having an affair with one of the guys that worked in our kitchen. And it just so turned out that her husband was some sort of roid rage-like bodybuilder guy and stabbed her to death in our parking lot about a year before I started working there. So this was a pretty big deal, right? It's a pretty big rule. And as luck would have it, after working there for about 8 months, I fell in love with this amazing woman who was everything I'd ever wanted. Not an alcoholic, not a drug addict, good person, smart, hardworking, beautiful. And it was the first relationship I'd ever had during my active alcoholism where that power imbalance wasn't in place. I was invested. So we're together for 2.5 years. Working in the same restaurant where no one is supposed to know that we're together. She's beautiful. I have guy friends. We work together. You think that won't fuck with you? It will. So we're together for a while. And then on Thanksgiving of 2008, some friends of mine who were very wealthy and who were out of town and thought I was a responsible adult were letting me house sit at their house. And I had a Thanksgiving party at their house. And more people than are in this room showed up. And it was only about an hour into the party where I was always already shit-faced, right? And one of the things I noticed happening at this party was one of my coworker guys coming on to my girlfriend that he didn't know was my girlfriend. And I became belligerent and made all 200-plus people leave this place in about 30 minutes. Most of them left once I started taking off my clothes. So, they all leave. She becomes very angry with me and breaks up with me. But we've all been there before. I didn't think she was going anywhere, right? But I was wrong. And on December 13th, while we were out having lunch, she let me know that she was interested in this other guy that we work with, and that she was leaving me. But that was fine. I thought. It wasn't. So, basically, 12 years of alcoholism, I'd kind of been the party guy, right? Because at Thanksgiving, like 200-plus people show up at this house, and we're having a great time. I mean, for a really long time, there were no problems associated with it. I never got a DWI. Not once, right? And I didn't have any hard drug problems. The only drugs I've never tried are crystal meth and heroin, but that's just because no one ever offered those to me while I was fucked up, because I definitely would have done them if you'd offered them to me. So I'd never tried those, but, like, you know, I paid my bills, never on time, but I paid them eventually, you know? I always paid them at some point. I had been kicked out of a couple of apartments. I still can't find my high school diploma or my college diploma. I have a feeling they were in the storage place that they had to auction off everything. Has that ever happened to anybody here? You put your stuff in storage and all that shit gets sold. And I had really nice green leather couches that recline and stuff. So someone hopefully has those and enjoys them as much as I did. But what happened was, after that night. Oh, by the way, I'm not drinking downtown anymore at this point. I lived off Westgate at the time, so my bar was Detour down at. Does everybody know that bar? Yeah, it's good times. My name's Bill, and the bartender that worked there at the time, her name was Hillary, so we were Bill and Hillary. And I shit you not, at Christmas time, they had an ornament that sat over my stool. And I remember being really impressed by that, right? You know, I was like, I'm a regular. I've got my own ornament with my name on it right here over my stool. And so that's where I did my drinking. And God, the place is a shithole. So that's kind of where it is. I didn't drink at home anymore. I didn't bring booze home anymore because I knew if I brought a bottle home that I wasn't going to go to work the next day. So I had all these little rules. The nice thing about drinking in a bar, yes, it was more expensive, but the other part of it was at some point they're going to make your ass go home, right? And yeah, I drove drunk every night on my way home from that bar. It was a regular occurrence for me to get up the next morning and go, fuck, I did a pretty good job parking last night. Look at that. Luckily, I never hurt anybody, but that's simply by the grace of God that I never hurt anybody in my car. Because there were plenty of nights I couldn't remember the drive home the night before. And so on a couple of weeks after that is when things really got bad for me. And when they got bad quickly. I was dying inside. The best thing in my life, the only thing that I liked about me, had left me. And I think outwardly, I kind of projected that like I was handling shit. But the second that I would get drunk, this idea would come in my head that I should just drink myself to death. And it wasn't like a scary thought. And me sober, that would be a scary thought. But once, like, I was 3-4 drinks in, the more that idea sounded like a really good idea. And I would come to the next day, and I would be terrified. Because it seemed like those thoughts were being injected in my mind. They seemed like they came from somewhere else. This was not, suicide was never something that I'd sat around and thought about. It never really seemed like a viable option. But now, in this 2-week period, every time I get drunk, that thought is entering my mind, and it is fucking relentless. And I was terrified. There was, it was that jumping off place that we talk about, you know? The solution had stopped being the solution, and it was now a big fucking problem. On Sunday night, December 21st, some guys that I work with were going to take me out of town because they thought that I needed to be around people. And we went to Elysium. It was a Sunday night, and they had 80s night, and it was cold as shit that night. Some of the roads were still icy. And then we went to Elysium, and we went there because it was 80s night. It was a good time, party. Maybe I'd meet somebody, you know, all those hopeful things. But as an alcoholic, I got really annoyed because it was so busy. And literally, there's like, you know, 14 people in line to get a drink, and I can't get my booze fast enough. And they can kind of see that I'm anxious, and so they're like, well, do you want to go somewhere else? And Club DeVille was still around at the time, so we walked across the street to go to Club DeVille, and it was like me, my two bros, and like 4 bartenders, and it was heaven, right? Like, this is perfect. This is exactly what I need. And as we're walking from Elysium to Club DeVille, something happened that night. It was the first time this had ever happened in 12 years of active alcoholism. My mom called me. I know, right? I'd never had to talk to her drunk before. She knew I drank, but she'd never seen this part of my life. And she didn't call once. She called like 15 times. Now, my parents were living in Washington, D.C. at the time, and I was a little concerned at that point, but I also knew I was in no shape to be able to talk to my mother. So I handed my phone to my friend, and I said, tell her we're downtown, I'm in line for the bathroom, it's really loud in here, and I can't talk to her right now, but figure out what she's trying to tell me. So he grabs my phone, kind of goes through the spiel. He goes, dude, someone called their house just a few minutes ago. She thought it was you. Sounded like you were in pain. She is terrified. Now she thinks I'm holding you hostage. And I was just like, what? She calls my phone about 5 more times. So finally, I walk outside Club DeVille. I pick up my phone. I'm like, hi, Mom. She's like, are you okay? I'm like, yeah, I'm fine. She says, I was just really worried about you. We got the weirdest phone call earlier. And I was like, look, I'm drunk. I didn't want you to hear me be drunk. I didn't want to answer the phone, but I'm fine. My guys are taking care of me. My girlfriend broke up with me. I'm kind of depressed. That's what's going on. She's like, well, okay. I was just really worried about you. And you're sure you're all right? I'm like, yeah, I'm fine. I'm fine. And hung up. And I really needed some drinks after that phone call. But it was the first sort of thing that night that got my attention. Something was happening that night. And maybe you've experienced this, maybe you haven't, but something was going on. There was something weird about that phone call that got my attention, that got me out of that drive that we get when we're in that mode to get fucked up. Something was taking me out of it and making me think about other people that night. And so the evening goes on. I'm saddled up to the bar at Club DeVille. The bartender on the other side, her name is Ruby, and that's important to me because Ruby was the name of my great-grandmother who had just passed away about a month before. She has beautiful red hair, and she's pouring me shots, and we're talking, and she says, what are you doing here? Well, I'm here getting fucked up, Ruby. I don't know about you, but that's... She's like, no, seriously, Bill, what are you doing here? What are you doing? And I said, well, my girlfriend broke up with me. It's kind of like the only thing that I have going for me right now, and I just kind of want to forget about it. She was like, you know what you need? I was like, no, what do I need? She's like, you need to go to church. This is Austin fucking Texas we're talking about, right? And I was like, really? I need to go to church? She's like, yeah. That's where you need to go to church. And I'm just like, well, okay. And I shit you not, like straight out of the fucking Twilight Zone, she says, I'm a Christian. And right as she says that, the other three bartenders that are working come up behind her in unison, like an after-school special, and are like, I'm a Christian too. Oh, and I'm a Christian. And I'm a Christian. And literally, for the next hour that I'm there, it's me taking shots while I'm being just like gangbanged by these Christians spewing Bible verses at me and telling me how much God loves me. But you know what? It had my fucking attention. I was like, this is fucking weird. Like, what the hell is happening, right? What the hell is going on? I don't remember much after that. I know that there's a brief memory of being in my driveway and my friend going, I can't open your fucking garage door. I'm like, okay, all right, well, we get something figured out. About 4 o'clock in the morning, I wake up. They've clearly undressed me and put me in my bed. But I've broken one cardinal rule. There's booze in my house that night. Now, I bought a bottle of Jameson for my buddy Billy for his birthday, which is January 22nd. Great idea, right? December 22nd, January 22nd, sure as fuck that thing's going to stay in there for a month, right? But at 4 o'clock in the morning, it occurs to me that that bottle is there, and I'm not drunk enough yet. So I go to my pantry. It was on the top shelf, still in a brown bag, trying to hide it from myself. It's freezing cold, but my garage door is down, and I walk out in nothing but a pair of underwear and sit down on the table in my garage so my roommates don't have to see me, and I start drinking this bottle of Jameson. I have no idea how much I drank that night. I have no idea. Never found the bottle. But I do recall laying back down in my bed and having it's a really bizarre sensation. I could feel my heartbeat all throughout my body, and it was intellectually and psychologically alarming at about how slow the beats were between each one. But I didn't care. There was a part of me that was going, you should probably call somebody right now. But there was no desire to get help. And I had this thought, and the thought was, this is probably it. But that was okay. I wasn't feeling any pain. And if you have to go, that's the way to do it. See, there was no thought of my sister, who was one of my roommates, who would find my body the next day. There was no thought of what that would do to my parents or to my grandmother. It was completely selfish and self-centered. I came to the next day at around 3:30. I had received an early Christmas present from my parents, which was a new bedroom suit. And I got one of those great mattresses, those Tempur-Pedic, you know, the squishy ones all the way through. Had new sheets and everything, stuff I'd never be able to afford on my own. And I was sleeping on one side of that queen-size bed. And my room was just filled with this awful smell. And as I kind of look out of the corner of my eye, there is this river of, like, antifreeze green vomit on the side of the bed. And my bed was pushed all the way up in the corner. And I realized that it had spilled over and it had gone all the way over the other side of the bed. And that there was now vomit underneath this enormous queen-size bed, too. So with a hangover from hell, I started cleaning up that mess. And as I started cleaning up that mess, I began what we do, which is the swearing off. I'm never going to do that again, right? There was a party that night, some restaurant folks, as we were getting close to Christmas. And my buddy Billy called me up and he's like, "Hey, you're going to go to this party?" I'm like, "Yeah, let's go to this party." So we get there. And I'm there for about 5 minutes and someone says, "Hey, do you you want to hit this joint?" I was like, "No, I don't." Another person offered me a Xanax. And I really needed a fucking Xanax. But he was like, "Do you want the Xanax?" And I was like, "No, I don't." And then Billy came over to me because he could kind of tell something was wrong. He's like, "Bubba, what do you need? What do you want me to do for you?" And I said, "I think I want you to take me to my first AA meeting." And he said, "All right. Where is it?" I had no idea. So we were way far over on the east side. And he said, "I'm probably going to take you to one close to your house. If that's cool." I'm like, "Fine." I said, "Well, let's find one." So we get out the phone book. This is 2008, by the way. You know, it's before smartphones, right? So we get out the phone book, and I find this number for this AA meeting. And I shit you not, it was called Last House on the Block. It's like, that sounds like the one. So I called, and I'm like, "Hey, I was wondering if there's any meetings today." He's like, "There's one at 10 o'clock tonight." I was like, "Great." And he says, "Have you ever been here before?" And I'm like, "No." And he says, "All right, cool." He goes, "Well, let me tell you how to get here." And he starts giving me these directions that I swear to God, like, involve going all the way past this one fence, then look for this tree. And I'm just like, it's like getting directions to a party. I'm like, "All right, let's go over there." And so my buddy Billy drives me all the way to my house, pick up my car. I drive to this meeting, finally get there, walk inside. There's like 14 people there. I'm 35. I'll be 36 in February of 2009. Like 15 people there, and all, like, the youngest one besides me is like 55. And the meeting goes. I'm looking at the steps. I'm looking at the traditions. I'm reading them. And I'm going, like, where the fuck do they tell you how to stop drinking? Like, where? Where is this stuff? I'm not here to kill fucking vampires. Like, tell me how to stop doing this shit. And at the end of the meeting, the guy who was chairing the meeting says, "So the last 5 minutes of the meeting, we open up the floor to anybody that has a burning desire. Anybody like to say anything?" Well, of course, they all knew each other. So all of a sudden, these 15 people are now looking right at me. And I was like, "Hey, I'm Bill. I'm an alcoholic." In my head, I'm going, I'm not an alcoholic. "I'm Bill. I'm an alcoholic." But then what happened was the realization that it was now almost 11 o'clock and that this meeting was going to end. And I knew what I had planned inside. And I was terrified. Because this might be the fucking night I do this shit, right? This might be the night where I actually die. And so I decided that for the first time in a very long time, I needed to get honest. And so I just let it all go. In this room full of total fucking strangers. And I think I talked for about 15 minutes. And after the meeting was over, after we said the Serenity Prayer and closed, one of the men came over to me and he had a big book. And about eight of the other men in that room came and circled me like a band of angels. Told me that they loved me. that they were pulling for me. And they had written down their telephone numbers in that big book, and they said, if you need something, you call us. And I had never experienced anything like that in my life. I'd never witnessed complete strangers go out of their way to make sure that I was okay. I had certainly never done that for a complete stranger. And one of the men, an older man, really sweet older man, probably 80, maybe 85, comes over and grabs me by the shoulder and says, what are your plans tonight? And I was like, fuck. And I said, I'm just going to go home. And he goes, well, I tell you what, let's go get some coffee. Do you like coffee? And I was like, yeah, sure, I like coffee. Also a little creeped out, too, because this is kind of weird, right? Like, it's 11:30, I'm going to go hang out with some 85-year-old. But we end up going to Magnolia. We're drinking coffee. We're kind of going through the first 164 pages of the big book. And I start looking at my watch once I notice him yawning. And he says, are you sure you're just going to go home tonight? And I said, yes, sir. I am definitely just going to go home tonight. And he says, well, all right. If you're just going to go home tonight, you're going to come to that meeting tomorrow night. And I said, yes, sir. I'm definitely going to come to that meeting tomorrow night. And he said, well, okay. Well, then let's part company, and I'll look forward to seeing you tomorrow. And I looked down at my watch, and I had another half hour before they called last call at the bar. And I got in my car. And I started heading down Lamar. And for some reason, for the first time, and as long as I could remember at that point, the idea that I should say a prayer came to my mind. And so I said a prayer in my car. And that prayer was this: God, I'm going to go home. I'm going to lay down. But if I roll around for more than 10 minutes, I'm getting back in my car and I'm going to go to that bar. So I went home and I laid down in my clothes. I still remember what I was wearing. It was a long sleeve red Old Navy shirt that said Old Navy down the sleeve, right? Sat on my cap. And the next thing I know, I woke up the next day at 11 o'clock. And it was the first easy night's sleep I had had in a really long time. And I look back at the night before and that day surrounding December 21st and December 22nd. And after 9 years of recovery, here's what I can tell you about that night. It was a window. It was an escape hatch. And it had a timeline. Because in 9 years of recovery, I've looked back, and you know what? There were several of those moments during 12 years of active alcoholism where I could have ended the suffering before the time that I chose to end it. It was by the grace of God that I believe that that window opened up. And it was by the grace of God that I chose that moment as the time to be the last day I would ever drink. I came to AA, and I will tell you one of the most painful things that I've ever experienced working this program is there were men, fucking giants, whose every fucking word I hung on, who are dead from this shit. Guys that I thought had it, they've got it, right? Guys, you know when they say find someone that has what you want? They fucking had it. And those guys are dead. Makes you really thankful for one more day. But also keeps you really humble. So what is like now? My first fourth step was written when I was 9 months sober. I did it in about 2 hours. And I did it because I thought if I didn't do it that day, that moment, I was going to drink. I'd been really, really lucky. The obsession to drink had been lifted very, very quickly after I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Started hanging out with all you folks. Wasn't doing any of the fucking work, right? But was having a great time. Had more friends than I'd ever had before drinking, which is awesome because when you first get sober, it sucks. I mean, you're lonely as shit. But I had friends now. I had a lot of cool people that were I was hanging out with, and I got to go to therapy every day. Right? But that's not the thing. I wasn't doing any of the work. So I threw together this half-assed fourth step, called my sponsor up. He met me 30 minutes after I'd put my last period on the page of paper. We went to the college campus in South Austin, St. Ed's. We went to St. Ed's, and I did my fifth step there. And honestly, there was no real relief after doing that fifth step. I didn't feel like any huge burden had been lifted off of me. I've done other four steps since then that were more fearless and thorough than the first one that I did. But the time between my first fourth step and my next one was almost 2 years, and I didn't drink between that either. And here's what I'm telling you, is that your half-ass effort can be sufficient to keep you sober. You've just got to fucking do something. I haven't done any of this perfectly. None of it. None of it. I went through 5 years of sobriety before I realized the whole prayer and meditation, the meditation part, wasn't fucking optional. The meditation isn't driving somewhere with nice music on in the background. It's not reading a good book on the toilet. Those things are not meditation. I didn't know that. Wasn't doing it. I've had sponsees in this program. I've tried to be their higher power. That doesn't work, right? I war with my higher power. Do you guys do that? Do you know what I'm talking about? Yeah. Like every fucking thing is like I have to put down my shield and my sword before I am just reckoned with. Right? No lessons came easy. I've had to learn them all the hard way. But what I can tell you is this. I've got an amazing life. I get to work with people in recovery. I get to work with you guys every day. I get to come be present, which is huge. I get to be present in the lives of people around me. My father passed away from cancer in 2013. And I got to sponsor my mother through his death and subsequent grieving process. And my mom's not an alcoholic. But I can tell you this, and I mean it wholeheartedly. The world is sorely lacking of sober alcoholics and drug addicts. Because once we get this shit, we are a healing force that moves out in this world and helps people to move through the darkest fucking moments of their life. And there's a lot of darkness out there. A lot. Those of us here in this room who have made the decision to walk through hell become keenly able to walk others through their own. Your pain will be a source of inspiration to other people. The things that you've experienced this world and the things that you will face without drugs and alcohol will motivate other people to be able to see things in their own lives that they want to change, irrespective of whether or not that's the drug or the drink problem, just little things. I think that we come here, we get sober, and we move through this world like angels. And that, to me, has been the greatest gift of recovery, to be the guy that has become sought after. How would you handle this, Bill? Party in the bathroom. So, when I walked my mom through my dad's death, I think one of the biggest things that I realized in that moment was that you can face painful, awful shit in recovery and not even consider the thought. The possibility of drinking. And if you're new here, I promise you, that those days will happen. You will experience terrible, awful things that you don't want to drink over. If you're new here, if you're new to the program, the best thing that I can tell you is just keep coming back, right? Sometimes an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting is going to be the sickest place you have been that day, right? As far as insanity. And some days, it's as though the gates of heaven have opened up inside the rooms and the voice of God has spoken through another human being directly to you. And those are the best days. On my worst days, I have learned to try to find somebody else to help. It has made me incredibly grateful for my life. And that has been an incredible source of happiness and prolonged happiness in recovery. To be grateful to be an alcoholic. That's really all I have, Chris. Thanks, guys.